of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Wisconsin writer Leslie Kagan applies a nostalgic look at the past to difficult circumstances in many of her novels. But in her latest title, The Resurrection of Tess Blessing, the difficult circumstances come fast and furious. There's mental illness, cancer, aging, loneliness, and even marital stress. But through it all, Kagan maintains some perspective and often a lighter tone. Like her previous novels, Kagan's latest is set in Wisconsin, this one in a fictional town just outside Milwaukee, not unlike the town where she now lives and which will remain nameless. Kagan will read from her book tomorrow night at Boswell Book Company, but first she joins us and tells Dan Harmon about how she maintains levity in the face of her character's adversity.
When I started to write The Resurrection of Tess Blessing, I thought, here is this woman who has reached, and I believe it's not only women, I believe men also go through this, a certain age where perhaps what we thought was so important or perhaps what was so important to us has now changed. Our marriage is changed. Our children are moving away. Are we sure we really love our job as much as we thought we did? And what about friends? And what about the deep sense of isolation? So there are a lot of things in this book that I think all of us go through. And when you first pick it up, the story up, I think that it feels like a lot, but that as you go through it, I hope readers say, oh, yeah, I know what she's talking about. Now, I think that it's really important, and I truly believe this, that humor is holy. I think, at least for me, that the only way that I can transcend pain is through humor. And one of the most difficult parts of the book, I think, for me writing it, is to keep that in balance, to keep that sense of importance about what I'm talking about. Yet, come on, if we don't stand back from it and say, wow, wait a minute, this is kind of strangely hilarious, even in the midst of the most awful things, you'll never make it. So it's a book about staying alive and surviving and what we all do to do that.
There is a lot in here that people will identify with, I think, a lot, especially people who have lived life a little bit.
Yes.
The over 40 crowd, maybe
yes.
The over 30 crowd. I think if you read this when you're 20, you're going to be maybe horrified at what you're about to encounter 20 years down the road.
I actually think that's very true, Dan, because I have seen a few reviews by people who clearly are in their 20s who are perhaps shouldn't be reading this book just yet, and they find it not romantic. And I just stand back and I look, you know, I think that when – I think sort of an interesting guidepost of this in some ways are weddings. You know, at different points in our lives, we all think of weddings in different ways. You know, when you're 20, oh, they're in love. That's, you know, at my age, it's like, oh, my God, children, run, run. I mean, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but oftentimes these things don't work out quite as wonderfully as we hoped they would.
Well, it makes me think back to when I was the age of her kids and
yes.
In college and thinking, wow, was I this insensitive to people that are going through some really serious problems?
Yes, you were, Dan. Yes. I think everybody at that age, and I think rightfully so, head sort of into a narcissistic cocoon. And I think that's all part of the developmental stage of, okay, I'm a teenager and or probably almost, I think, up to 30. People are very self-oriented. And I think part of that is deep exploration, trying to understand who the heck they are. But they're also unbelievably sure that they have the answers to everything.
You sum up the 15-year-old boy pretty well.
Yes.
Early on in the book.
Thank you. my son. And I think that this was a shock to me. I had not come much of the story is – not much. I'm not going to say that. That wouldn't be true. Of course, whenever I write anything, there's always a basis in fact and reality because I simply can't do it any other way. Somebody approached me once to write their story. I said, Really? No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I think there are people who do that. I'm not one of those. There has to be some element in all of my books. There's always an element of truth and based on reality. I hope they're all truthful in my own kind of way, but there's an element based in reality. I find boys, teenage boys, pretty horrifying. Honestly, I hate to be so blunt, but this was something I was not used to. I'd come from a family of all girls. And so when I had my son, I was just mystified. Really? Right. Is that really what you're going to do all day long is text? Oh, you're texting. Okay, great. All right.
Well, but it does provide some levity.
Yes.
And I'll just list it off again. I mean, you have so many serious things going on. Without giving away too much, I'm hoping if we are, let me know. But
yes.
Cancer, midlife, marriage.
Yes.
Disinterested children.
Yes.
But then what makes it all, I think, I don't know, even more intense is the fact that she's incredibly lonely.
Yes.
No one to confide in with all this going on in her life. And then except for
Grace,
the narrator of the story.
Grace.
Maybe tell us about Grace.
I'm going to tell you about Grace. Grace is, it's very interesting to me, and I'm not sure actually at this point if I'm sure who Grace is. I think Grace presents herself to Tessie in a way that we're not sure if she's a guardian angel, if she is a part of Tessie who knows better than she, if there's a sense of some sort of spirituality that's going on, if it's an almost psychotic break in a way. We're not sure exactly who Grace is, but we know she's benevolent and that she loves Tessie. And I sometimes wonder, does it really matter to feel that kind of love and deep and profound love? Who cares if you've had a psychotic break? I'd do that. I think that each reader will bring to the book that which clicks best with them. Who is Grace? What does Grace mean to you? What is Grace as a concept? Grace is named Grace for a specific reason. So I think that's a part of the book that I kind of, you know, is she your imaginary friend? We just, I don't know that we ever really know. And I think in many ways, as you read the book, she changes. Sometimes you feel, oh, for sure she's an imaginary friend, or, oh, for sure she's a guardian angel. Oh, no. She's part of Tessie. So I think as the book progresses, at different times, she's different things.
And how far do you need to go as someone that creates a book as far as resolving issues? Where do you leave off and let the reader decide for themselves what a resolved issue looks like?
Well, for me, I like a story that does have some resolution to it. I think that stories basically, you have to understand they are entertainment. And I like the idea, especially with everything being so unsettled. I think it's specific to every story. This story has so many elements and so many layers that I think that some sense of resolution is important. Unfortunately, in life, that rarely happens. So I think that what we have when we read the book, as in life, are temporary resolutions until the next problem, the next thing on our to-do list pops up.
A resolutionette. Maybe.
Yes, a resolution, a mini resolution, yes.
I just want to throw this at you, and it's kind of an odd thing. We were talking about it a little bit, but we were talking about Russians.
Yes, and, yes, we were.
And you said that you have some Russian appreciation, and it got me thinking about how this book does sort of read like a classic Russian novel, where it ain't all roses and, you know, happiness. It's, you know, I would say that the classic Russian books are in touch with the kind of more dark side, if you will,
yes,
or the suffering side.
The real side.
The
real side of life. I mean, I think that there's a tendency now in life, and I've found this over and over and over again, and I'm starting to feel a little isolated about it. look, life is really, really hard for all of us. So can we stop pretending it's not? Can we stop presenting, hey, let's stay positive at all times. And hey, come on now, let's go. Where's that? Hey, turn that frown into a grin. Come on, turn it upside. Look, that's ridiculous. We have such hard lives in so many ways. And I think that we're all really pretty hesitant to present that because, in essence, when we do say, I'm sad, I'm really sad, I've lost somebody I love, or I don't know what I'm doing, either it involves a huge trust level. And yeah, I get that. That's scary. But I don't think you're going to get any traction in resolving or coming to grips or even being able to look at what's going on within you. If you aren't real about it, don't, you know, the other thing is anger. Now, nobody can get angry. Now, anger is a bad thing now. Somebody actually said to me, oh my, you shouldn't be so angry. I said, what? What? Are you joking? What do you mean? I should have been angry. It was completely appropriate to be angry in the situation that I was angry in. But now, anger, sadness, anything on the other spectrum of gleeful, happy faces is beginning to be frowned upon as unacceptable. This deeply concerns me. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing is that people get very frightened by that kind of emotion. Don't be scared. It's okay, because what it does is it puts you in touch with your own sadness and your own anger, and it can be frightening to people. But I think the more we talk about this stuff and the more we acknowledge it, the easier it'll get.
Well, you know, it made me think that, wow, I wonder how many people out there are suffering in silence, or, you know, for the reasons you just said, they're not able to express their anger or discontent or sadness, because it's so not what we do in our culture to express that. We have to feign being happy, even
if
we're not.
See, but Russians don't, do they?
Oh, they
are just, you know, that's the part that I, you know, when you talk about a Russian fairy tale, yes, when you talk about, I think, almost Russian culture, nobody is shying away from this. Nobody's, you know, pretending that they're happy all the time. And I think that if we could be honest about mental illness is, I think, the next great area that we all really, really need to discuss in this country. Treating mental illness, letting mental illness, airing it out, emotional imbalance. I think it's one in four people in this country suffer from an anxiety disorder. That is astronomical. And I'll tell you, as a person who has dealt with this for a very long time, the difficulty of dealing with the anxiety coupled with having to go out in public and pretend that I'm not anxious only compounds it 100,000 million times more. So if I could just turn to somebody, I mean, I have to admit that, you know, this is stuff that happened when I was younger, and now that I feel pretty comfortable with everything. But at that point, to just have to go into the grocery store could be so overwhelming that if I could have just said, hey, I'm having a panic attack. Is that everybody? That's right. That's cool. Okay. Without having to be something that I wasn't, for fear of rejection, for fear of ridicule, for fear of disparagement. That would have been a lot nicer.
I mean, we're talking about it in kind of general terms and as far as our culture goes, but is that something that you really wanted to get across in the book? That
yes.
There's people that this kind of pressure to pretend to be happy is very damaging.
Yes, it is extremely damaging. And I don't think people realize that when they go home at night and they've pretended all day long and they come home and they're by themselves and all of this pain is still there. We have lots of problems in this country with drinking and drugs and all sorts of people going to, you know, doing excessive things to deal with their emotions. And if we could just be a little healthier about all that and let that stuff come out and deal with it and try to be as accepting as we possibly can. I really truly do feel that mental illness, emotional imbalance is the new gay. I think that for many years, the whole gay thing, I mean, obviously, there are some parallels here of having to hide and to be ashamed and to not let anybody know. And I mean, the sadness of that breaks my It just breaks my heart. And I know there are millions of people feeling that way right now, anxiety and depression and a sense of detachment from others and the need to present. And when you think about this, I mean, nothing could be truer than Shakespeare, "All the world's a stage," when we're all getting up every day and pretending to be happy, happy, when, wow, you know, I'd like to think of all of us as being a lot more complex. Mm.
Yes. Well, to just shift it a little bit,
yeah.
I mean, you have the intentional use of the word and name Grace,
yes,
the narrator of the story, but also the word resurrection, you know, the very title of the book. And this is, I didn't view this as a religious book in any way, but more
yes.
spiritual, if you will. What is it? I mean, obviously, resurrection implies hope or
yes.
something to look forward to, if you will, or things can change. So this book is not without its, you know, positives either.
I think that in terms of the resurrection, I think that for Tessie, and I will just talk about that in specifics, I think that we all get to that point in our lives when we've experienced profound loss, especially when we have choices to make. Or we can either keep going or we can give up. And I believe that Tessie's resurrection is embedded in her in some way. Her deep and unwavering love for her children, I think, is what drives Tessie to keep moving onward. And I think that when she sets up her to-do list at the beginning of the book, her to-do list changes at a certain point, and her desire to keep going is not based on her desire to stay alive. It's her desire not to hurt her children. And I think that all of us have something like that, something that's incredibly important to us, that if we're quiet and we dwell on it, something is important to us, something quiet, and there's a confidence within us that will tell us what that is. And that is our little resurrection. And if we choose to move forward with that, there's some work to be done. And there is work to be done. How do I go about this? How do I pull this together? How do I keep going? And is it important enough to me? What do I do? And I think that's when you get out the for real to-do list.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it wasn't quite put this way in the book, but I mean, Tess is going through some serious issues, but it doesn't really, you know, I mean, I would say she's a really strong person.
Yes.
You know, she can dig deep and find it in her reserves because she's been going through these things all her life. So in a way, that's, you know, that's something to be considered, looked at, admired,
yes.
Noticed.
But she does not for one second perceive herself that way.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That's what's really interesting. She sees herself as pathetic, really, and I think most people who are dealing with issues see themselves that way. They see themselves as losers and pathetic, and why can't I get this together? And how come everybody's doing so much better than me? And so that self-perception is really hard. But when you really look at Tessie's life and what she's literally enduring to get to the next stage, or some sense that maybe there might be a next stage, she's pretty impressive. I have to stand back and say, Tessie, you are rocking this.
And I think that people that read this and everyone's, you know, got issues swirling around their lives
yes.
and have been through really tough things, I think will – hopefully, I think people will see that in themselves. That's, you know, hey, I hope so.
I think when you write a book, you want to touch people. I mean, that you really want to touch someone so that they can read this, perhaps somebody who's feeling some of the things that Tessie's feeling, and see her own self or his own self in Tess and say, oh, yeah, you know what? Now that I reflect on this, I'm doing really well, considering mm-hmm. I'm doing really well.
Right. Well, Leslie Kagan, I've enjoyed this book as well as the others, but I've really been enjoying reading this book. I'm not finished yet.
Okay,
I'll admit that. But
so we'll talk.
We'll talk more.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming in.
Dan, I write these books just so I can come and talk to you.
I'm glad to be your muse.
You're my
inspiration.
Muse. You're my muse, Dan.
All right. Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Milwaukee native Leslie Kagan's latest novel is called The Resurrection of Tess Blessing. Her previous novels have included Whistling in the Dark and Good Graces, among others. She spoke with Dan Harmon. And Kagan will read from her book at a launch event tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company. One more break now, and then reporter Susan Bentz brings us a story in which the environment and art co-mingle. Keep listening. There's more of Lake Effect in a moment on WUWM.